Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkar. And more importantly, today I get to speak with someone who's been on the podcast a couple times before, a friend and colleague, Dr. Caleb Simmons, associate professor at the University of Arizona. We're talking about a fascinating new SUNY publication, 2022, called Singing the Goddess into Place, Locality, Myth, and Social Change in Chamundi of the Hill, a Kannada folktale. Caleb, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me again. I'm excited to be here for, what I believe, the third time.
I believe so as well. I know it's not your first rodeo, but I think it might be your third. I always remember that you were literally my fifth guest.
Oh, that's amazing.
You were my fifth guest on the podcast, and now you're number 215.
And congratulations for making it over 200 as well. It's quite the milestone.
Well, you know, in my retirement years, it's quite easy to produce the podcast, you know. No, I'm teasing all of you out there, you know, especially the job market. I'm still working. I'm still productive. I haven't retired. And then wait, we had you back on. Tell me the second one. Remind me of the second one time we had you.
The first one was Nine Nights of the Goddess, which was also SUNY. Yes. And then the second time was my first monograph, Devotional Sovereignty, Religion, and Kingship in India. And that was with Oxford.
Absolutely. Okay. Totally remember now. So you're a busy boy. Second monograph in a couple of years, eh?
Yeah, you know, it comes from a lot of the same momentum as my first book. I had sort of all this information about Chamundi and tried to put it together. And ultimately, it was enough, honestly, for five or six books. And I'm just still making my way through it. Mysore is such an interesting place and changes every day, as, you know, most Indian cities do. And it just, you know, it's just sort of rife for so many conversations in the study of religion and study of Indian culture more broadly.
It's a rich, rich, rich place for sure. So I think the subtitle says it all, but nevertheless, what's the book about?
Yeah, so the book, it's takes as its primary subject matter a folk ballad entitled Betara Chamundi, or Chamundi of the Hill, as it's translated throughout the book, which tells a... It's really a romantic comedy. It's about the goddess Chamundi, who lives on Chamundi Hill outside Mysore, and her relationship with Nanjundeshwara, or Nanjunda, and who's a local manifestation or local embodiment of Shiva, and their trials and tribulations. It sort of follows sort of a formulaic rom-com mode, but in that, it's a great mirror, a great reflection of life in the region and the things that happen there, the religion, the social interactions between castes, marriage rules, like all of it is just embedded in there and makes for an extremely rich collection of songs and stories.
And so this body of work, this Kannada folktale, how are you what are your methods? Like, how are you looking at it? How are you using it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And
I only ask great questions.
Yeah, exactly. And this is one that's, it's been a little troubling because, you know, I'm not a musicologist. And so when I'm talking about songs, a lot of people want me to dive a little bit more into that aspect. And, you know, I'm just not capable of doing it. So I lean on the strength of my training in religious studies, which is, you know, largely ethno-historical, but then also sort of literary history. So I read it very much as a text. And this is one of the things that I struggled with as I was writing, is that I'm taking this very dynamic tradition and taking a snapshot in time and then dissecting it. But in many ways, it winds up being true to some of my other interests and your own interest in Puranas, that they're, you know, these dynamic performative texts that then get codified and concretized in one thing. So you can see as you go through the text that it's got some very old elements, it's got some newer elements. And the particular version that I'm working with was originally collected by a great Kannadiga folklorist, Professor Rajashekara, who published it and was very, very kind in letting me work from that. And so between his version that he had collected, and this was by a Kamsali sort of master balladeer, Mahadevaya. And between that and other versions that I heard, you could see even then how I'd been updated since Rajashekara collected it in the 70s. And so you wind up getting, again, it was a sort of a weird process of looking at a dynamic song that changes in performance, yet wanting to mine out some of the questions that I had left over from my own time in Mysore, my own research. And that was really about, it all started with thinking about Stala Purana and how localities tell their own history, not within a narrow sense of like, you know, human history, but a broad cosmological version of their own history, connecting it to Puranas, to gods and goddesses, and how those gods and goddesses are alive in the very place. So that's how I started. And I thought the book was going to be completely about sort of myth and locality. And then with everything going on in the world as I was writing, the idea of social change started to become foremost in my mind. And so there's it sort of shifts toward the end when I start thinking about sort of this embedded cultural context. This is not just a reflection, but it's they're advocating for change as well.
Which, since you talk a little bit about how the book ends, tell us about the structure. How are the chapters structured?
Yeah, so it starts off with an introduction in which I kind of lay out the overall narrative in a very short, condensed way. I introduce the major characters, the goddess Chamundi, her sister Utnali, and then Nanjandeshwara, and sort of tell about their situatedness, their temples, the background historically. And then I introduce, of course, the song itself, the community that sings it, and a little bit more about that performative culture, and then get into some theoretical questions about calling it like a folk ballad. What's the value in saying folk versus something else? What's the value in myth? Sort of interrogating some of those larger ideas. And then I kind of, you know, march through the subtitle sort of systematically, in which I start off with, you know, looking at the very first song, which is about the myth of the slaying of the buffalo demon. And just kind of analyze it on its own, because it is it's its own story. And I'm careful not to say it's a derivative of the Sanskritic story, because it's not. It has meaning on its own. And so I look at it, but then I also do compare it to other versions that you find in Devi Mahatmyam, Devi Bhagavata Purana, and see how this myth does different work for the community, like talking about Mysore's locality and specifically how caste plays an important role constantly in the understanding of place. And then after that, I start talking about in the next chapter about it's also a source for urban history, So most of the time when we write histories of cities, and I've done this with Mysore myself, I just look at the royal archives and say, here's the history of royal inscriptions, royal histories. But then when you look at this, they understand the history of the place differently. So if you think about how the city's grown, how the neighborhoods are divided, all of this information is embedded. And then the next chapter, we'll move on. This is chapter four. Look at the narrative and the argument for social change related to caste and intercaste marriages and the way people treat one another based on their perception of caste, which leads into the concluding chapter of the analysis, in which I look at these terms high and low, because they're actually terms that are used throughout the ballot itself to think about what is high religion and what is low religion, and thinking about it in a new way in the context of the goddess and Southern Karnataka, in which high and low are important terms, but they refer to different aspects of the goddess, namely that the high version is related to giving of moksha and vegetarianism, and low is, you know, giver of enjoyment and is non-vegetarian. But these aren't related to valuations. Both of these are important parts of the goddess tradition, and they have to work together. Then finally, there's a translation of the songs, so people can kind of follow along a little better.
There's a fascinating analog to this work, and that of a scholar, Noor van Bressel. She looks at, doing a collaborative paper, she looks at another regional goddess narrative, Kerala, the Bhadrakali Mahatmya, that's what it is. And part of what we're doing is comparing, okay, so where do we see parallels in the Devi Mahatmya, and where do we see things that are entirely local, regional, and there's a synergy. And so could you comment a little bit about the high-low in this context? And in your view, is that comparable to, or is that distinct from how we have, we sometimes teach Hinduism as, you know, the big tradition, little tradition?
Yeah, no, this is another really good thing for us to reflect on. And why I wanted to make sure I included it was based on that sort of ethnographic portion of this work. Whenever I would go to Chamundi Hill, and I lived there for 2 years, so I was there pretty frequently throughout that time, at least several times a week. And I would usually try to walk the steps from the base to the top every day. At the base of the hill, people are worshiping Chamundi. And the rituals they do are generally self-led. Sometimes they'll hire a religious or ritual professional to help them, and they're often blood sacrifices. Even though this is technically illegal, there's, you know, police see it and sometimes even engage in it. And then you go up the hill, same people. So it's not like they're not allowed to go up. So then they go up, and then you go to the temple. And then when you get to the temple, there's, you know, Dikshita Brahmins are the head priest. And so they run a very Agamic temple. It's, you know, based on the Shaivagamas, and she's vegetarian. And I tried to work through this with both people at the bottom of the hill and the top as they were doing rituals. And I was most shocked probably by some of the conversations with Shashi Shekhar Dikshita, the head priest of Chamundeshwari. And he was explaining, because I was like, isn't Chamundeshwari, she's vegetarian, right? And he was like, no, she's not. And even within, you know, this priest, his version, he was like, we don't do them here, but she likes blood. It gives her power, and people do it. You just have to go down a little bit. So, and that was the exact term he used. It wasn't like you don't have not go outside. So it wasn't about outside of the temple. It's down. And literally, because she's up on a hill, you could see people just go down a tiny bit and do rituals. And this included people who worked at the temple for certain rituals. I've seen, you know, not at the top of the hill, but not very far down either, people doing chicken sacrifices. And so as I started to reflect on this more and more about the go down portion, I started to realize that there is a three-dimensional ritual landscape in this place that both were incorporated, but somehow the verticality of the space was tied to these rituals. And again, even with the head priest talking, it wasn't like he was saying, like, you know, these people don't understand, because it's something you sometimes hear with people explaining vegetarian Hinduism versus meat eating, is like, oh, they don't understand, they're superstitious. But he gave them, you know, same validity, and said they were important rituals, the goddess needs them both. And at that point, I started thinking, like, this really isn't, when we use high and low, we put this like value system on it often. When the way it was being used in this specific context, it's no valuation. It's just about ritual placement, maybe would be a good word.
And so then would you not see the hill as hierarchical, or would you see the verticality as hierarchical in some way?
I mean, there are inherently some hierarchies that become overlaid on it. I mean, if you look at economics, for instance, the Chamundeshwari temple now has become very wealthy, and through that, so have the priests. So there's some social hierarchies that are embedded, and that's, you know, also at the heart of these stories. But when we talk about ritual efficacy, probably it's an inverted hierarchy. That blood is sacrifice is seen as being way more efficacious and way more powerful. So it flips that on the end. And of course, it's all about goals, as we know with the goddess. Like, you can want this worldly things, or you can want the otherworldly. And that's the great thing. As I mean, I'm, you know, telling you this, but in the Devi Mahatmya, all my students, when I teach it, they're all just like, oh my goodness, how could the king choose to rule? And but actually, the story is all about him.
That is my first book. That sentence right there, that's my first book. The Devi Mahatmya is not, it's exalting the king's dharma over that of the merchant, rather than exalting the merchant over the king. It's saying, you know, this is an important dharma. This is the dharma of the goddess, protection, bloodshed. And there's this snippet where they sacrifice a lot of their own limbs. And to me, this speaks volumes. And it's all conjecture. I mean, as far as I know, this would be your area of expertise, but it really feels to me like there were traditions. I mean, the reason we don't have the great goddess in the Hindu fold before circa 5th century CE is at some point she was introduced to the Brahmanic world, but clearly folks have been worshiping her for centuries, if not millennia. And clearly that worship involved, you know, the mother is emblematic of this material creation, that, you know, beings eat beings to sustain themselves. And it just seems to me that there seems to be this, you know, it just a conjecture that there is this perhaps tradition of blood sacrifice and honoring a great goddess figure in this manner that far predates, you know, the Brahmanization thereof. And people have that cultural memory. They're like, nope, that's the more powerful ritual. That's the first one, right? That's, you know, it's primal in some way.
Well, to that point too, I mean, if you think of this case of Chamundeshwari and Mysore as being like a sort of sample of this, the temple wasn't Brahminic until the early 19th century. It was, you know, agriculturalist caste who were the head priest until Krishnaraja III basically imports Tamil Dikshitas in to take over. And then you wind up getting this very complex hierarchy of priest within the temples. And so I have somewhere in my notes, like, they were trying to explain to me like the different castes and their ritual roles and how this meant they related to one another. Like, and they literally said, like, this one's the top, this one's number two, this one's number three. And so there's five caste groups who are the priests in there, and they're all assigned different roles and duties, which then come with prestige. So, you know, all of these things wind up being overlaid with all of these like social caste-based issues that tie back to ritual, which, you know, the more you're in India and the more you do research, you know, as a white man coming in first, like, nobody really wanted to talk caste with me. And honestly, it was tough. And so I didn't want to bring it up either. But then more and more people, as they got more comfortable with me, they started also discussing caste. And it's just sort of an assumption about ritual purity and caste. And, you know, of course, we all know this. And it's not everyone is aligned. And that's another thing that came through this book is like, when you think about someone who is, and I'm using air quotes here, low caste, they don't really see themselves as low caste often. like they may know this the way people perceive them, but like in the Dave Raguna subcast with the Comsoles, the people who sing the song, they come from, they view themselves as descendants from the founders of Vijayanagara. And they were descendants of Shiva and Parvati themselves. And so if you think about that as their lineage, I mean, they're not saying like, oh, we were born low because of our previous sins. They're just saying, y'all don't understand we're much higher than this.
Fascinating. Do you want to play a little bit of it for us?
Yeah. Let me play a little bit. So what I'm going to play is a very small snippet that was shared to me by Professor Rajashekara. And it's not the other recordings that I have of the songs are very bad, but this is he is not just a folklore scholar, but also creates music and dramas himself. So this is in the same musical style, an updated version that he himself wrote. And it was recorded in the studios of News One Canada. So the sound quality is very good.
ಬೇರೆ ಜನ ಎಲ್ಲ ದೆಗ್ಗೆ ಕಟ್ಕೊಂಡು ನೋಡ್ಕೊಂಡು ಹೋಗ್ತಿದ್ದಾರೆ. ಈ ಜೋಗಪ್ಪನು ಆನಂದವಾಗಿ ಹೋಗುವಂತ ಕಾಲದಲ್ಲಿ ಅಡಿಗೆ ಮಾಡತಕ್ಕಂಥವ್ರು, ಒಲೆ ಮೇಲೆ ಹಾಲು ಕಾಯಿಸ್ತಕ್ಕಂಥವ್ರು, ಹೊಸು ಮಕ್ಕಳಿಗೆ ಎದಪಾಲು ಕೊಡ್ತಕ್ಕಂಥವ್ರು ಈ ಜೋಗಪ್ಪನನ್ನ ನೋಡ್ಬಿಟ್ಟು ಅವರೆಲ್ಲ ತಮ್ಮ ತಮ್ಮ ಕೆಲಸಗಳನ್ನ ಬಿಟ್ಟು ಜೋಗಪ್ಪನ ಬೆನ್ನತ್ಕೊಂಡು ಹೋಗ್ತಾ ಇದ್ರು. ಆಗ ಜೋಗಪ್ಪನವರು, ಮುತ್ತೈದೆ ತಾಯಿ ಗಳೀರಾ, ನಾ ನಿಮಗೆ ಪುತ್ರನ ಸಮನಲ್ಲವಾ, ಪುತ್ರರು ಅಳುತ್ತಾರೆ ಎತ್ತಿಕೊಳ್ಳಿರಮ್ಮ ಅತ್ತಾಲೆ ಹೋಗಿರಮ್ಮ.
Yeah, so as you can tell, it's pretty lively.
Yeah, without question. And when you were doing your research, when the folk ballad, as you call it, was playing, what was happening? Paint a picture for the listeners.
All right, so I am glad you asked me this question because I want to give you the full history of me and the story.
I don't say this to other guests, but I only ask good questions. So I'm teasing.
So I was in Mysore on the American Institute of Indian Studies Kannada Language Fellowship, and I had already completed the intensive summer program and was about to start the year long, and I saw an ad in the paper for a new drama, a new play that was going to be playing at this open air theater. And it was called Chama Chelave. Didn't recognize the words. So I asked my professor what it was about. And he said, oh, it's about Chamundi. And so I was like, all right, this is a good chance for me to really try my new learned Kannada. And so I went. And I went on the first night, and there was probably 50 people. And it was another person, Sujata Aki, had written it. She's also from this community. And she had updated it a little bit. And they had actors actually portraying all the roles. And so instead of just being sung, and as the singers who were part of the acting troupe, they would sort of go around from scene to scene, and then people would act it out, and the narrative parts would be spoken by the people playing all of the divine characters. And it was amazing, absolutely amazing. It was hilarious. It was in pretty like refined but spoken Kannada, so it was pretty easy to understand. Of course, I didn't get it all. It took me many, many times listening to it and reading it to really get it all. But it was enough to where I knew like this story was amazing, and funny and heartbreaking and heartwarming, sort of all at the same time. And I was like, I want to know more about this. So I went on the second night. The crowd grew to probably from 50 to about 100. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to go to the third night. By that time, there were hundreds of people there. This thing wound up running. It was supposed to be a 1 week thing. It was students who were putting it on, students and people who worked in like IT there in Mysore. And they wound up having to like quit their jobs and become professional actors and sing this song every night. And it wound up moving from Mysore to Bangalore to one of like the big theaters. And so it was huge and it resonated. And of course, this gave me like more interest in it and finding like the different folk versions. And, you know, there's been several folklorists who have collected the different versions. P.K. Rajashekara, I mean, his book, Maitra Chamundi, the intro has a bunch of great discussions of other published works on the subject. So it's extremely rich. It's like whenever in that version, like I said, people were acting it out. Usually when you hear it, it's a small troupe of singers who you have one person who's like the lead, call them narrator, and then you have like the troupe. And Kamsale actually isn't the cast name. Kamsale is like a nickname for the part of the subcast of the Devaragudha, and it means cymbal. And so there's these little cymbals that they have on their fingers to keep beat. So you have people with that, sometimes someone with what looks like a tambourine, sort of keeping beat, and then they would just sort of stand there and sing the songs. Usually, you know, depending on where you are, you would get a few people gather around and give money. And then, of course, there were more sort of curated shows where they'd be planned, and then you would get bigger crowds. But you could hear it in a lot of different contexts, or even just not all of it, small portions of it here and there. Often, again, in the context that I would hear small portions would be people sort of, you know, street performers looking for donations.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
What do you most hope people might take away from this book? Core takeaways, themes.
Core takeaways. Well, the thing that I most want to share is the songs themselves. The story is just amazing. It's just so much fun, and it's just a great story. And then once you get the story, I think that almost anyone can sense it's like latent magnitude, that there's something there that is powerful. And so I hope from the book people get that this is powerful in different ways for different people. And I think that's the beauty of art, is that it can speak to someone interested in the city. It can speak to someone about the cosmological significance of Mysore, but it also can talk about the realities of a place. And it can talk about caste discrimination and how people are discriminated against daily. And it's manifest in name calling and physical violence. But ultimately, those caste distinctions are social constructions that can change. And that's really sort of the heart of it, is like, if you really think about, and in this case, it's people's connection to the divine, those caste distinctions aren't that important because everybody has access to different sort of ritual modes. So that's, you know, not as a spoiler, but I think people can kind of guess. Chamundi and Nanjandeshwara get together in the end, and it's because his other wives recognize that she's powerful, and she has, in this case, the ability to raise people from the dead and do like tantra mantra magic. And so they recognize this, and they say, you know, her being of a quote unquote low caste isn't important because she's just one of us. And so I think that's sort of the, yeah, that's really my key takeaway, is that I want people to understand that these songs aren't just mythological tales, but they do things, they do work.
And mythology itself does work. And these yep. songs do even more, perhaps more pertinent or pressing or timely work. And I mean, there's so many key themes. Go on, sorry.
I was going to say, that reminds me, and I think people dismiss mythology, and it reminds me of an article by Travis L. Smith, which I cite all the time because I still find it powerful. And he was one of my PhD advisors, and it was about the Kashi story and how it had embedded within it debates of the time. And that always impressed upon me that, like, we think things that happen, millennia ago are just these old stories. I mean, not us as scholars, but often our students, these are just like interesting old stories, but really they're embedded in these social systems and in these debates, and they were speaking directly to people, which I just find endlessly fascinating.
Without question, the vibrancy and relevance of the Puranas and such tales, perhaps it is easy to overlook that absent a Pauranika or a bardic figure or someone telling the tales, but these tales live, and they're meant to be retold to audiences in particular regions, in particular languages at particular times. And I just finished, every once in a while I get a sessional contract so that I can corrupt the youth at some university. I just finished a contract at Lethbridge University, taught a couple of courses, and I must have fooled them into thinking I was a good teacher, because they renewed it for the summer. And I designed this course called Myths of India, not a misnomer. the new book, Stories Behind the Poses, just came out towards the end of the course, so I couldn't assign it, but I ended up, don't tell the publisher, leaking most of that book to the students because the retellings were a little more accessible than the Van Buten and Dimit, 70s classical Hindu mythology. And that was, we had discussion in every class, and I was so impressed. And so, I was impressed that the students totally grokked the ways in which this could be relevant. I mean, some of them had to do with the tellings, but they took it in all kinds of directions, and they were able to apply it to all kinds of stuff happening on the ground right now. And I think that is the power of myth, like its relevance, its potential relevance to speak to large themes, sociological themes, psychological themes, blah, blah, blah. Enough of me interrupting to wax poetically.
I agree with you. I mean, because the thing that, I'm trying to think of which scholar it was that mentioned this. It's older. But anyway, it's about, just how myth can take a story of like local significance, of local meaning, but then by putting it in these narratives of gods and goddesses, it winds up making it have so much more gravity. Right. So something, if you tell a story about, somebody over here, somebody over there with like sort of, they have a name, but they're faceless. Now, all of a sudden, if you tell the same story and it's the goddess you worship and the god you worship, now people can, they can envision this and they can start to think, well, maybe this isn't the way things ought to be. Of course, it's very like when you think about David Mahatmya, you have the work of Cynthia Humes with Vindhyavasini, who says like there's a disconnect between deities and real women. Of course, there is, but there is a way that stories like this that are meant for, again, the folk, the broader populace, they can make that connection in ways that a Sanskritic tell like isn't able to resonate. So I think that's, with these folk ballads, it's a power that they have that's unique.
Yeah, without question. I just, you'll have to look at it at some point. It so reminds me of the Bhadrakali Mahatmya in many ways. And also, I had Brenda Beck on a few months ago, talking about her work on a Tamil folktale that she's been working on for decades. There's so much fascinating work in this field. And I won't get too nerdy. I don't generally talk shop on the podcast because we need to make it accessible, but I can't help myself. I have to say that one of the ways, for example, that this particular iteration of the feminine divine perhaps problematizes an existing typology. In my view, that typology is problematic to begin with, but the typology of the breast goddess versus the tooth goddess, the typology of the independent, fierce, Chamunda, Chamundi in this case, and yet she's also very much a consort goddess, right? The whole ballad is a romantic comedy, as you playfully put it. And so, do you want to say a little bit about that tension? Or if there is one here?
Yeah, I mean, the tension is maybe not so obvious at Chamundeshwari, because when you see the goddess, when you go into the temple for darshan, like many temples, you're kind of far away from her and she's covered in flowers. So you can't really make out what the image is at all. You can kind of see part of a face, but it's got so many years of sort of smoke and ash and soot that it's like, caked over black color now, or I guess charcoal color. But she's a stone and she's the slayer of the buffalo demon. Whenever you get closer. And again, I've been very fortunate with having such a long relationship with Chamundeshwari, is that they will often allow me back for, things that most people aren't allowed to see. So you get to see, and it's, it's a pretty old image, maybe not as old as some people want to say it is. No art historians, I won't try to exact date it. But people don't really see that version of her very often. You just see, like I said, the flowers and a little bit of the face. What you do see is her Utsavamurti, the one that comes out, the festival image for procession twice a day. And that image is really quite abnormal for a Chamunda. She's looks like a baby, has a sweet little infant face. If you look very closely, she has fangs, but you can't see that when she's being processed. You have to be very close. But now my Instagram blows up every day with Chamundeshwari photos. So it's, one of my great joys in life is to wake up and see, hundreds of photos of her. It's one of those you can now see it pretty predominantly. But before we had access to so many images, you just have to use your eyes, and there you couldn't really see the fangs because she really looks like a baby. Again, she holds her weapons, but she's not, killing a buffalo demon in the image. So she has sort of more of the identity of Durga, but not Durga sort of in the act of blood letting, but Durga sort of as a subdued, that's not a great word, but a more docile moment in her life. And then locally is where you get all of the connections with her with Shiva. So she kind of becomes Parvati. So she's, if you're looking at like a spectrum of goddess, and you've got Chamunda on one end and Parvati on the other, with being one being domestic, one being sort of wild, or the tooth and breast, and then Durga's in the middle. This is Durga leaning toward Parvati, except for one night. And that one night is the eighth night of Navaratri, when she's the celebration of her killing Mahishasura. And in that night, the processional image itself is transformed. She wears a wig that's like sort of dreaded dark black hair. She wears a garland of skulls. She wears a skirt of arms. She's just transformed into this goddess that looks extremely fierce, even though she still has that little infant face that's masked behind all these other wild elements. And then that night is the only night that the temple is 100% closed for its rituals. And what you hear from the outside, and I was invited to go into to watch the rituals, but there were some issues with some other people trying to get in, and so I decided to defer. And so I'll always have this question of what went on that night. But you hear gunshots, you hear loud drums, you hear fireworks, all this going on in the temple. So, I mean, I'll let other people connect the dots, and I won't quite speculate what's probably going on in the temple that night. But at least for that one night, she is completely fierce. So fierce that in, was it 15 days later, she has to be put to sleep for a night to allow her to completely cool off. And then she's woken back up for her the rest of her ritual year, in which she's sort of the infant docile goddess. So she's both. And I think that's, you know, thinking back to one of my other mentors, Kathleen Erndl, with her book, Victory to the Mother. That was kind of her point, is that the goddess is all these things. We just only highlight certain of them at certain times.
Fascinating. Who might most benefit from reading this fascinating book? What subfields, or what, you know, you get the drift.
Yeah, I mean, it's written for my undergrads, and I point that out in the preface, is I was never intending to write this book, but when I teach my women, goddesses, and power in Hinduism course, which is actually adapted from an old course that Kathleen Erndl taught, every student, it's cross-listed with gender and women's studies. So the questions that people have are like, how does this affect real women? And it's based on sort of the construction of the course, in which we ask some of these like great second wave feminist questions about, you know, what if we all worshiped a goddess? And so that's one of the themes. And every semester I teach it, I wind up having to talk about this story. And finally, I was like, I just need them to be able to read it. And then that started the process. So it's really meant as a text to have conversations with undergrads. But that being said, I still think it's valuable for scholars to think of these questions, the theoretical questions about high and low, really, because they're terms that we don't use in religious studies anymore because of its valuation, inherent valuation. And I think that that's problematic because traditions themselves use the term. So it's something that we're, you know, forcing traditions to let go of because we're uncomfortable with the way that, you know, Orientalists used to use it. And so part of it is to say, like, these terms are meaningful. We just have to be respectful of the traditions that we're studying and understand how they use the terms and how verticality is incorporated into their system of meaning as well.
Well, verticality and or hierarchy is not unique to any given culture under the sun. It's just a question of first learning and understanding how folks understand themselves before imposing our value system or our hierarchy
exactly
to them.
And I do want to put, verticality doesn't always mean hierarchy, and that's hierarchy is there, but it's not, the two aren't
one's not tantamount to the other. So, right. So if, unless I misspoke, what I meant to say just now, I hope I did, is verticality and or hierarchy.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Excellent. So, is there anything else about the book that you wanted to touch on in the podcast?
I just want to continue to emphasize, and I think we've already done this a lot, but hopefully if people are thinking about using a book on Hindu goddesses in a broader course on Hinduism or religion in South Asia, that, you know, one of the things when we think about religious studies and overall enrollments and all these trends that we have to think about, I think part of the reason is a lot of people are expecting us to really talk about current events and how religion plays a role in that. And often, and I was guilty of this a lot myself, I was really interested in like historical aspects of it. And this book is very much a product of my own learning about pedagogy and making things relevant for my students. And to think about, you know, even if you're telling, you're teaching a course like I do on Hindu mythology, it's still a great opportunity to have students think through issues of social injustice. And there's plenty of resources for us to do this and to push our students to think about power dynamics and to think about inequalities and what we can do for equity and how, you know, people who are underrepresented and are discriminated against listen to their voices because they have ideas about how we can overcome these inequalities and how we can achieve social change. And they're embedded in stories like this. So we just have to open our eyes to it and open our students' eyes to it. And then we need to talk about it. Because that's one of the most important things that, you know, sometimes is missing from the discussions. We need to have frank conversations.
Indeed, stories from the epics and the Puranas are replete with moments of people being discriminated against for a variety of reasons. And the moral of the story is that person has something very valuable to offer. Mm-hmm. There's so many. This morning I was just doing a little bit of teaching on one of the stories from the book, Ashtavakra. He's deformed. He has he's physically disabled, a sage. Physically disabled because of his father's curse, but he's the brightest mind, brightest sage of the day, and they wouldn't let him participate in the debate because of his disability. But once they do, he actually wins the debate.
And so, right?
You know, I mean, fascinating. I better not go down the rabbit hole of Indian myth. Just otherwise, you may not do anything else today. I want to. Thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. It's always a delight to chat, whether it's on the podcast or elsewhere.
Indeed. And speaking of elsewhere, what I want to do is formally extend an invitation to you that in so doing, I'll also extend to members of the audience. No one knows about this yet, but we're going to tell them now. At the for scholars, South Asianists and friends, anyone at all interested, we're going to have the first, hopefully, probably annual reception at the American Academy of Religion and New Books in Indian Religions. A reception generously sponsored by New Books Network. All other podcast hosts who maybe there are welcome. I'll issue personal invites, of course. But for some reason, I feel like you should be the first person to be invited to this. And in so doing, the cat's out of the bag. So 6 to 9 on the Friday, it's sort of your South Asianist watering hole to kick off the conference.
Well, I am truly honored, and you know I'll be there. So hopefully we'll see lots of people.
Yeah, and in the program, I think rather than call it the New Books in Indian Religions reception, I couldn't resist the alliteration of the fun. It's called the New Books in Indian Religions Podcast Party. It's called a party. It's the podcast party. We're having a party. Great. I think it'll be good fun. It'll be good fun.
Yeah, it'll be awesome.
In Denver this year. Okay. For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Caleb Simmons of University of Arizona on fascinating new SUNY Press publication called Singing the Goddess into Place. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, and keep contemplating the power of myth and art to affect change in our times. Take care.